Okay, to start off, I'd like to get an idea of, if you raise your hand, those of you who have taken a course in Orthodox, this regular college, micro or macroeconomics, would you raise your hands? Oh, pretty good. How many here have read Beyond Bombay? Just to get an idea of how much you've read in Austrian stuff. Certainly less. Okay. I propose to start with the first theme here is Crusoe economics, as Mary Lou said, one of the reasons for this is that the format, I'm new at this thing too, I'm not new in teaching economics, but new in this sort of format, so we're moving our way here. But to start with one of the things that shows the distinctiveness of Austrian economics is the method by which it develops the discipline. And this is very different from other economic schools. So we start off with Crusoe. Robinson Crusoe was landed on this so-called desert island. It's not really a desert. I mean, if it was really a desert, he probably would die fairly quickly. It's an island of resources and so forth. And he has technological knowledge, quote-unquote, of things to do. So the first point, I think, or theme is how most of the economic concepts can be developed just by looking at Crusoe vis-a-vis nature. In other words, the idea of this thing is to start off very simply with one individual, without bringing in other people yet, which makes it, of course, more complicated. One individual vis-a-vis nature and what happens. So I don't know, I could give a spiel first and then have a discussion. I'd rather sort of get a feel now of what any of you think, start the discussion off. What concepts can be approached through this kind of method? You start off with Crusoe, he's there, it's day one, he's been shipwrecked, he's standing there on this island, and now what? Okay. Can we start with more on this? In other words, what do you think, what concepts do you think can be developed? What economic concepts?
I think he's mapping, you're going to come to a conclusion if he sits there waiting for the welfare state to look it up, he's
right.
Not going to get very far.
That's for sure. Anything more concrete?
He's going to get off his ass and start
right.
Looking.
Exactly.
How's it going to show?
In other words, he's got certain goals he's got to achieve, right? Pretty fast, obviously, in this situation.
He's going to arrange them in hierarchical structure. What's
right.
Most important immediately?
Right. His priorities. Okay.
Food first.
Right. Food
Buildings.
First. Presumably shelter next. Because you start with
maybe
these
water
those.
First.
Water. Water.
Yeah, water. Right. An island. You've got to find some fresh
right.
Water somewhere.
Pure water first, yes. Then food.
Yeah.
He owns everything, presumably. He doesn't have to worry about the fact that other people may own.
Yeah, there's no other people yet. I know, well, see, that we get, that's a little bit later on. The question is what ownership is. What do you mean by ownership? So
it's all there available for his use.
Let's postpone that until we get to Friday. Friday makes his or her
and
appearance.
Really, even if he doesn't own the island, even if he knows to begin with the island is wholly owned by somebody else, he would act the same way. Because he would like to support himself.
I'd rather just start off an unowned island.
But it's important to make that. I should point that out.
Okay, so he's got the
water pits.
Thank you.
Okay. Friday just arrived.
Nobody's mapping them big enough. Okay, so he's got certain priorities, as Lisa said. He's got to arrange them in some way. And one of the concepts in the most schools have this. Most so-called orthodox, mainstream, I call orthodox economics, has this. But it's kind of differently organized, as we'll see later. He's got priority. Okay, he's got choices. He's got water, food, shelter. Now, these are not. This part's not broken down. He's got food, pretty much. As you go along, I don't know if you ever saw the movie Swiss Family Robinson, which is sort of like this. A Swiss family named Robinson gets on there, and they start like this, and after a year or two, they got a whole big thing going, like boardwalks and gardens and that sort of stuff. So as you go along, you get more affluent, your food requirements become more specialized, right? Then you look for Wheaties or whatever and stuff. But Crusoe, presumably starting off, doesn't have this problem, okay? And then the clothes. Right, whatever. So you've got this, let's call it in economics a value scale, okay, a scale of goals or ends or purposes. Now, one of the things, by the way, this is sort of interesting, is that I teach at a place called Polytechnic Institute in New York, or it used to be called Brooklyn Poly. And I first came into the department, you know, the social science department, they knew I was great. I had these crazy ideas, bitterly opposed to laissez-faire and so forth and so on. This is a department of half Marxists and half liberals. So they had me give a lecture, and I started off with goals and ends and means and sort of stuff, so the basic axioms of Wall Street economics. And they fought this bitterly step by step. They refused to admit that people had goals, for example. yeah, because I think even though in their daily, in their regular scholarly work, much less their daily life, they realize that people have goals and they act on them and so forth and so on, but they were scared stiff that they've conceded one point.
Oh, yeah.
So they have to line up at laissez-faire.
Which, logically, they have to.
That's right. They sort of sense this, right? So it's really weird, hard to sit there for an hour and a half and argue about people have motives or goals or not. Anyway, that's... Okay, so you've got goals. And, of course, by saying this, you're also assuming that people have goals, they have choices, they can do something about it, which is the Austrian concept of action. Okay, so the whole concept of action comes right in here. That people act, and in order to act, you have to have goals or purposes or ends in mind. Okay, so that's wrapped up in the concept of action. And priorities and value scales or preference scales for goals. Right? So this is one of the things that will go on here is that one of the problems which cause confusion in economics is linguistic or semantic with the sort of words that are used have historical reasons for it. In other words, people start, for example, economics didn't really begin, but systematically began in early 19th century England was agricultural. So a lot of the words of cement are agriculturally based, which we have a different language now, so it's a little difficult. We'll see if we go along. For various reasons, this value scale, preference scale, is called economics utility. So this already causes confusion because most people, when you think of utility, think of something which is useful, and it's not this is not what we're talking about. We're talking about the subjective valuations of the point of Crusoe in this case. So in the value scale, or the utility scale, you see the confusion that can come in, like critics of the market, for example. People like Galbraith or whatever. Well, Galbraith, by the way, lay at your door here in this country. You're responsible for this joke. Anyway.
I object.
You're dead. Yeah. Right? We got plenty of problems too.
I understand.
Okay.
But anyway, I never bought his book either.
Okay.
I'm
reading,
but I never buy it.
Is Galbraith an ass Galbraith or Galbraith up here? What is the
I hear it both ways. Galbraith.
I'd have to get really mad.
Okay, it's not a vital point. At any rate, so the people like him would say, well, these are not the certain goods and services which he likes or he would call useful in some kind of objective sense. Right? There's other things which other people like are not useful. Then you can have a quarrel about whether. For example, back in the 1950s, when he got launched, there were Cadillacs, those days, had tail fins, if you remember. And there was a big hysteria among people like Albright and other left liberals, attacking tail fins as being evil, as being wasteful. I wasn't a great tail fin fan myself, I never saw anything wrong with them. So the point is that utility then doesn't mean in economics what somebody says is objectively useful, whatever that's supposed to mean. It means whatever people is useful to them, what they would like to achieve, what goals they like. Whether other people call that wrong, irrational, wasteful, whatever. In other words, utility in economics, certainly in Austrian economics, has a subjective connotation. It's subjective valuation on the part of the person, the actor, the individual, the consumer. Okay, so. That doesn't mean there aren't such things objectively useful or not useful. The point is that from the point of view, looking economics looks at it from the point of view of the individual actor. This, by the way, was always a problem when working with Randians in Austrian economics. Rand believing in objective value, he's like, how can you have a theory of subjective value? It was a big problem. Randians. And of course, the answer is we're not talking about, this is not an ethical course in ethics. Economics is not this ethical discipline. If you're dealing with ethics, you can say something might be objectively good or bad, or useful or not useful. economics analyzes the individual actor as he or she acts, and so that the value is the valuation of a part of this, this person.
In that sense, it's value-free and being objective
values. That's right. Exactly. So it's value-free on the part of the economist in the sense that we're not imposing our values on the individuals. Okay, so that's trying to analyze the situation. Another thing about Austrian economics, which is, I think, unique, is that what we're doing here is we're taking certain common sense facts, such as people act, people have goals and purposes, and basing an economic discipline on that formal fact without going to the question of what his purposes are. In the case of Crusoe, we're talking about food and shelter, etc. But basically, we don't really care what the purposes of the individual are. The fact that he has certain purposes and goals to achieve, that's all we need for the discipline. So we're not interested in economics, what he should be valuing, as I said, or you know, whether he's a nut for doing it or something. That's not whether he should be eating butter or cornflakes or something. That's another discipline, aesthetics, ethics, whatever you want to call it. So that's the one of the things which are confusion which come in. Okay, so we have we're just really beginning with this. We have a value scale here, and we have action, concept of action. Anything else anybody can see as a concept is applied in action. Crusoe. Okay, he's got, what has he got? He's got, to try to keep away from the actual content, like, you know, I mean, you always have that example of when he shoots deep and gets a bow and arrow or something, or catches fish with a net. Basically, the idea is what sort of concepts come in here? What has he got? He's got his own person. He's got himself. And he's got, okay, he's only going to achieve his goals by his own person. No, nobody else there. He's going to be doing it. He's got personal energy. And you've got technological knowledge. I mean, in a sense, they're combined, of course, but the point is you can conceptually say you've got technological knowledge. Technological, of course, in this case, is not high tech. I mean, computer programming is not going to do them a lot of good here. It doesn't matter. Technological knowledge of how to catch fish, filling a net, getting a bow and arrow, whittling a stick, and all that sort of stuff. This is low tech, but it's tech. Okay. So you've got technological knowledge. And he's got natural resources. He looks around, sees what's going on. There's trees, there's berries, he can eat, you know, strawberries. There's fish, there's water, and so forth. All these things are nature given. Okay, so we've got nature given resources and natural resources. So where are we getting concepts? Economic concepts are coming in here. Now, again, in economics, the semantics are different. The language was set in the early 19th century, more or less. Personal energy is defined as, in economics, labor. Right? Now, the problem here is the way, for example, and there's used to be a big discussion, a controversy, in the history of the Andrew Jackson period in the United States, the 1830s. Were the Jacksonians labor leaders, or were they some sense like the present? Were they early ancestors of the New Deal, or semi-Marxists or something? They said they were in favor of labor. They kept talking about labor all the time. Now, since Marx, most people think of labor or laborers as being industrial workers, assembly line types, you know, construction workers, whatever. Labor in the early 18th century sense meant anybody who uses personal energy in production. We haven't defined production yet. Anybody who transforms resources, what it means, into using personal energy. So this, in the modern world, would mean not just industrial workers, but the president of General Motors along with the assembly worker. Anybody who's using personal energy in the production process as a laborer. So it's already, you see, the causes all sorts of problems if you're looking at current 20th century terminology and economics, which has something 19th century concepts. Natural resources is also a similar problem. Natural resources are defined in economics as land. And again, so this is again a difference here. One is the land includes water, rivers, fish where the fish are, includes offshore oil at this point. It doesn't just mean land in the sense that we're used to it, you know, this body of stuff, soil and stuff. Now it includes space, get something out of space. include radio frequencies and all that. All this is nature given. Okay. So on the one hand, it includes much more than we common sense nowadays think of as land. On the other hand, it also doesn't include buildings, for example. This building is not considered land, technically. The building is man-made. So what would be considered land would be the ground underneath the building. Okay. So that's...
What about cows and things? Would that be land?
I think wild animals
are land.
Right. I think. Yeah.
Of course, domestic harvest them.
Yeah, domesticated would be like something else, which I haven't got to that yet. Something else is. Okay. As soon as man enters into the picture and transforms things, then you have something else. The land is always there, of course. You always have some ground to stand on. So land always enters into the picture, but there's also this other thing. Another thing. Anything more discussion on this? I don't want to keep talking anymore. Problem with that? Extra.
There's a problem to me with it right now, because I would distinguish between unowned and owned natural resources, but I don't see the distinguishing between an apple tree and the apples it bears and the piece of land that it grows on. Really, I don't really see.
No, that's the distinction. Yeah.
I mean, I see certain reasons for distinguishing, but not in a general category.
Well, apple would be nature given.
Not if it's growing, if it's a domestic orchard.
Right.
I don't quite see the difference.
No, at this stage, though, the assumption is that the island is unowned.
Yeah, the ownership hasn't even come into the picture yet.
So it's not.
We haven't even defined ownership.
There's only one man on the world.
That's right.
That's
one
man.
Right, precisely. So uninhabited.
So everything is there.
So everything physical on the island is land.
And surrounding it, and underneath all
is
there.
Now, the other question I have is, you haven't put a word opposite technical knowledge yet, are you concerned?
I don't think so. I think we're sticking with that.
Because I included that with labor. I mean, in the sense that the old idea of labor was to the executives and so on are laborers too, the inventors and so on, and the technical knowledge and the personal energy cannot really be distinguished and separated. I think they're both labor. I mean, they aren't from a Marxist point of view, I agree, but they shouldn't.
I don't know, see, the problem is that the things about technological knowledge which are different from other resources. Once you get it, you don't lose it. Right? In other words, it's I wouldn't say it's non-scarce, but
it's not, the personal energy is consumed, it's used up.
You get tired.
That's true, technical knowledge is not.
Technical knowledge is once you've got it.
Once the recipe is being created, it can be passed on.
Recipe is another word for it, yeah. Mises uses that. It's a little different. And conceptually, of course, technological knowledge is important, growth of it and stuff like that.
Okay, all I was thinking of is you think of these basic categories of economic resources, mm-hmm. The one is land and the other is labor, mm-hmm. And so technical knowledge, if you're going to split it that way, would have to go into labor.
Oh, sure. Obviously, nature doesn't have technological knowledge. Okay. So, I represent so anyway. Okay, another thing, of course, that he finds is, I like to start off my classes in microeconomics with what I call the Garden of Eden model. The Garden of Eden, either mythological or actual, there was superabundance. There was no scarcity. The definition of the Garden of Eden is it was superabundant. If you want to have a Pepsi trickling down your throat, you wish for it, you snap your fingers, and by God, there it is. That's the Garden of Eden. There are certain logical problems in the Garden of Eden model. Supposing what I wished for and what this gentleman wished for clash. Okay. But aside from that, by definition, everything is superabundant. If everything is superabundant, then there's no problem with private or property ownership. As a matter of fact, no problem with price or scarcity or anything. There's no economics, because if you want something, it's there. If you want a hi-fi set, it's there playing Bach, whatever you want. So that, presumably mankind was in the Garden of Eden in some sense originally, and was kicked out for various sins and heresies. So what Crusoe faces, of course, starkly, what we all face, is the world of scarcity. You know, all things are scarce, all resources, all goods and services, etc. And because they're scarce, you have to allocate, you have to have the value scale. Crusoe can't just say, okay, I want to fix a nice suit of clothes from Brooks Brothers, and I want to, you know, fake the Alaska and so forth, because he ain't going to get it. I mean, so he has to do all sorts of stuff. He has to allocate his time, has to allocate his energy, has to allocate, has to have priorities, do the first things first, and so forth, and so on. So he's, so we live in a world of scarcity. Our scarcity is less than, say, Crusoe's, obviously. Crusoe's an extreme scarce problem. He dies tomorrow if he doesn't get food quickly. We're not in that bad shape, obviously, but we still have a world of scarcity. If things weren't scarce, everything would be free. It would be like wishing for Pepsi and putting it in our throat. Now, there are intellectual fashions. I don't want to shock you people, but there are an intellectual world or fashions sort of like ladies' hemlines. Every 5 years, some new gimmick comes in, and everybody follows it. And one of the few benefits of advanced age is you see all these things come and go. Same junk, you know, comes back 10 years later and it drops out or something. So about 10 years ago, during the period of the New Left, for a couple of years there was a big hue and cry, not so much among economists, among some New Left economists, mostly among intellectuals, sociologists, people of that ilk, English professors. That we now live in a post-scarcity age. All these things, all this economic stuff about prices and all that, it all was true until 1960, I think 68. But now this is 1968, by God, we live in a post-scarcity age and everything's great. We don't need all this stuff, is now obsolete. So I had a debate one time with a neo-Marxist professor around that period. He was giving this whole line of chatter. By the way, the conclusion of it was always is you have to have socialism, whatever the problem is. Okay? We live in a post-scarcity age, therefore there'd be total unemployment, then we have to have socialism, or something like that. It's kind of nonsense. But anyway, so he was telling me we now live in a post-scarcity age, all these economic truths are obsolete. So I said, look, Professor Averill, his name was, if we live in a post-scarcity age, why don't you burn your salary check? You know, what's the point of having an income? You know what his answer was? It was unbelievable. He said, well, it's because I too am... And brainwashed by the capitalist ethic, capitalist ethos.
It's rough.
Yeah, it's really rough.
That's right.
A few years later, the same people were saying that the post-scarcity thing drops out. The same people were saying all resources are dying. Like in 5 years, we won't have any resources. And therefore, we have to socialize. Right? It's amazing. I mean, it's just.
Well, he's certainly true. Socialism will cure the post-scarcity age.
Right.
It's such a thing at the moment. Right. It's sure there won't be an abundance up to then, kind of.
Right, exactly. It'll cure the excess of affluence.
Right.
So, anyway, we live in a world of scarcity, and as the world progresses, we have less things are less scarce, but it's still there. Okay, so that comes in, obviously it comes in all of Poussin's action. In fact, action is really you need action because of scarcity, because you haven't achieved your goals yet. He's got things to reach the goal. He's got natural resources, he's got personal knowledge, energy, and technological knowledge. And these are his resources, or means, equals means to achieve the ends. Resources, means, for his, another way of saying the same thing here. That he's got priorities, he's got goals, he has to achieve them, he has to use these resources and allocate them, hopefully in a proper manner. Okay. Another thing is that all this takes time, right? Action takes time. No such thing as acting in a timeless vacuum. So he's got to, each one of these things will take a different amount of time. He's got to figure out this thing in 3 hours, 6 hours, 3 days, 2 weeks. So time is another picture. I mean, one might think that it's kind of self-evident, but orthodox economics or mainstream economics, microeconomics, if you read textbooks, time washes out. Everything is moving around a timeless universe. There's already a key distinction. There's only a half hour into this thing. Key distinction between Austrian economics and everybody else. Namely, we incorporate time into the analysis.
Could you almost put time along with those other things on the right? Natural resources, personal energy, and
talent? Yeah, you have to allocate time. And the things move through time. Action takes place through time,
of course.
Right.
But those aren't actions. Those are resources. You know, say, time's a resource.
Yeah, time's a resource, yeah. And one of the... way, because I don't keep talking about Randians, but one of the problems with Randians' theory, okay, which is totally tangential, is the Randians tend to think as if time is unlimited. There's no problem with allocating time. And that you do one career for 20 years, and you move on to another career for another 30 years, so on and so on. Certain as if time were sort of not a problem. Okay.
You must be getting more acutely aware of that than some of us, perhaps.
Yes. But there's always, time is always scarce. And that's the. Then there's also another factor which enters in, which again distinguishes Austrians from everybody else, namely, life is uncertain. We know certain things can happen, we can predict certain things, but it's uncertain. We don't, Crusoe, might be a hurricane tomorrow, with a whole, stock of fish or something, strawberries gets wiped out. So, we have uncertainty. So one of the things that, again, distinguishes Austrian theory is the Austrians incorporate uncertainty into the picture, into the analysis at the very beginning. Life is uncertain. Things can change. We don't have perfect knowledge of the future. We now already have a deviation within the Austrian movement. Some Austrians are now going too far, so edging into nihilism, say like Professor Lachmann of South Africa, and has gotten to the point of saying that we can't know anything about the future. The future is sort of like a total blank wall. We can't predict or forecast anything, which I think is around the bend. So that's. But basically, the Austrian view is that there's no certainty in the future. We can know some things, we can predict some things, et cetera, et cetera. In contrast, neoclassical economics or standard textbook economics, which is essentially Walrasian at this point. Leon Wallach, Swiss economist, wrote in 1970s, 1880s, approximately. His famous work was published the same year as, I think, 1873 or something around there, in the early 1870s. In Lausanne, Switzerland, neglected during his lifetime, I think. Properly so, myself. rediscovered by Pareto, who was a brilliant sociologist, a very interesting person anyway. Italian Pareto. Which has now become standard, more or less standard microeconomics. And many will keep referring to this. And one of the things which the Paretians or Walrasians, one of their theories is that everybody's got perfect knowledge. Perfect knowledge of the present, perfect knowledge of everybody else, perfect knowledge of the future. There's no uncertainty. There's no time either, of course. Time, in a sense, drops out. Time becomes just, let me put it this way, if you, perfect knowledge, perfect certainty. All right, see, if you look at it this way, you might think this is all crackers, bonkers, but this is the orthodox mainstream economics at this point. Perfect certainty. And if you live in a world, so what does this mean? It means a world without change. We know, or change can be perfectly forecast, which really means without change. Then time becomes something very different from what human beings are experiencing. Time becomes an endless round of everybody doing the same things. Knowledge is frozen. It's like a freeze frame. Okay? If knowledge is frozen, of course, everybody gets perfect knowledge eventually because there's no change. So, I think new enters the picture. Anyway, this is the world which the Walrasians depict. And this is why you have the whole mathematics and the equations and the diagram, because if everything is, there's no change, there's no uncertainty, there's a perfect knowledge, everybody's got perfect knowledge, then you can just crank it out. There's no action. Action really disappears in the Walrasian universe. We'll get to that, explain that a little later. So this is a very different kind of economics. Uncertainty then means that each individual person, Pousseau and everybody else, is an uncertainty bearer. He's got to meet uncertainty. And this function of meeting uncertainty, which we'll explain later on in much more detail, is called entrepreneurship. He knows his goals. He's more or less has good inventory of resources, but now he's got to act on it. And by doing that, he's got to forecast, hopefully correctly. He's got to meet conditions and try to achieve them. If he makes too many mistakes, he's dead. Okay. Or in our case, we make too many mistakes, we suffer monetary losses. So this is the entrepreneur is the uncertainty bearer. Another thing about Crusoe is given the goal, let's say his goal of getting a gallon of clean water. Given the goal, he wants to achieve the goal as rapidly as possible. Okay, by definition, it follows the definition of action. If you've got a goal, you'd rather have a gallon of water now than wait 2 weeks. Okay. So this immediately brings in the Austrian concept of time preference. A lot of hassle about time preference. And basically it means, I think properly understood, it's an extremely important concept. But the person, given the goal, the person prefers getting the goal now than getting it later. Otherwise it's not really a goal. Something else is intervening here. There's all sorts of disputes about that. A characteristic one is something like this. It's now the winter. Go back to the pre-refrigerator age, and people use ice boxes. In the winter, you don't need ice boxes. You don't need it very much. You really need it in the summer. Therefore, if this is December, you prefer getting the ice in July than you would getting it now. So doesn't this contradict the concept of time preference, the preferring something now to later? The answer is it doesn't contradict it because it's not the same problem. In other words, we're given the goal, we're given the good, the thing itself, and the resource itself, the object that we're valuing. We're assuming a homogeneous object. In other words, we're assuming it's the same serviceability, the same usefulness. Otherwise, it's a different object. So that ice in the summer becomes a different good, even though it's the same physical object, same cube. It's a different good in the summer than it is in the winter, perform different functions. It's much more important in the summer. It has nothing to do with time, just that it's hotter in the summer, you need ice more. So the answer to that is something they're two different products. Given the product, given the good, given the thing, given the equal usefulness, people prefer getting it now, getting it later.
Surely that's only true if the amount of labor to get it is the same.
Hush.
I mean, for example, if you've got a choice of either paying for something now or letting someone buy it for you free of charge tomorrow, you don't need it till the day after.
Oh, sure.
Then, you know. So I think labor, you know, it's the total amount of resources used, and time is just a resource the same.
Sure, you're balancing the end of the goal, the value scale, with what you have to do to get it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, sure. It's one of the keys. People prefer less labor extended. Right.
I want an easy life.
Right.
Right.
Any other comments on this? I'm going to make this a monologue instead of a temptation. All right. A good, by the way, we haven't defined a good. That's important. It's always used. The good is a thing, either a commodity or a service, either tangible or intangible, which consists of an entity, which is valued by somebody, obviously, otherwise it's not a good, either by Crusoe or by us or somebody. An entity with consisting of N homogeneous units. This is relates to the ice problem. Let's see. The N can be anything from 1 up to, 100 million. The idea is that the units have to be homogeneous, in other words, they're the same. So if you have a certain grade of paper clip, certain size paper clips, you have a box of, 50 paper clips. Each paper clip is a unit, or the box is a unit. Units can vary. But the idea is that each unit is homogeneous to the other unit. Yeah?
Well, doesn't your illustration about the ice cube contradict the the idea that anything could be colder than this. We've got a kilowatt hour of electricity at 3:30 in the afternoon on a cold winter day when everybody's watching a football game. It's quite a different thing from a kilowatt hour of electricity, say, at 2 a.m. in the morning in the springtime.
Sure.
But it's never the same.
I don't think it's ever the same. I mean, that's the ice cube in July, any given ice cube. The thing is, up to the person. It's up to the sense that the individual. Here I am. I don't care which block of ice. Let's say it's the same size, the same hour. I'm buying ice, a block of ice. I don't care which block of ice I'm getting. It's homogeneous to me. It's physically homogeneous, and it's homogeneous to me. But you can't tell, as an outside observer, an economist or statistician, you can't really be sure that it's homogeneous, because different individuals might have different valuations on it. That's the point. One of the things about Austrian economics is that it provides very, and one of the reasons why it's not popular among economists, is it provides very little room for economists to do much. Economists can teach this, can explain the beauty of it. We can't advise government, for various reasons we'll get down, but probably do already. We can't advise businessmen either. We haven't got really any, there's very little job opportunities for Austrian economists except teaching and writing and whatever. And so the economist doesn't have that, the outside observer doesn't have that much of a role, because you can't really say that. Well, let's take an example. In classical economics, it's totally different. They say this is the objective unit, and therefore it's the same. Good. I think John Stuart Mill had this, and was a classical economist as well as philosopher, lousy philosopher, not too hot on classical economist either. At any rate, he's a very bright guy, until he screwed up. Mill is looking at the market. He has a concept we call economic man, a very pernicious concept. And he's looking at the market, and he sees that according to the economic analysis, goods tend to have the same price. We haven't gotten the price yet, but it's pretty clear now that if you have a block of ice, three or four ice dealers in the same block, let's say, the prices will tend to be about equal, because if Zeke over here is selling ice for, $50 a pound, I don't know how you sell ice anymore, $50 a cube, if somebody else is selling it for $30 a cube, Zeke is not going to last very long. Okay? I mean, they're going to have to lower the price in order to stay in business. So Mill is observing the world, and he's saying, there are situations where they have different prices for the same good continue almost permanently. Therefore, it's irrational. Therefore, these people are non-economic men. They're wrong. They're whatever.
You mean they're just not following his ideas?
Well, yeah. He was looking at the physical object rather than the subjective evaluations of the individual consumers. So many of these consumers, they're different. The same thing might be a different good, or the different good thing might even be the same good. And, for example, the first...
There's extensions, too. I mean, the one ice that has to charge more money might give a premium delivery service, and the other
exactly.
You have to pick it up.
Exactly.
The good is all those
exactly.
things together.
Precisely. That's another big Austrian insight. When you're buying something, you're not just buying a physical object, you're buying the whole package, the ambiance, whether the guy is friendly or not, whether the service, whether he gives credit, a whole bunch of stuff which is involved, which most people don't look at. For example, New York, they have a very posh restaurant, the Foutesse, one of the poshest in the country, and they sell ice cream. Let's assume it probably is not the same ice cream. Let's assume for a minute it's the same ice cream as McDonald's or Breyers or something, a fast food store. And yet, Foutesse will charge 10 times as much as McDonald's for the same ice cream. And the reason is you're not just buying the ice cream, you're buying the whole ambiance. You're buying the servile waiter, you're buying the expectation of maybe seeing Jackie Onassis at the next table and stuff like that. You don't get it at the McDonald's.
You're also getting more comfortable chairs, luxurious.
Exactly, precisely. You're buying the whole package. The whole
floor.
Right. Precisely.
In that case, though, the good is the ice cream. Period. That's the only thing that can be defined as
good. No, in this case, good is the whole package. The reason why it's a different price. And it stays at a different price as you're buying the ice cream plus the whole service, the whole ambiance. The whole
it's
not a homogeneous good. In other words, the ice cream, even though it might be the same physical ice cream,
it's simply not comparable to what's in McDonald's at all.
Don't
you
say
apples and oranges?
Yeah.
I'm just trying to understand this.
Yeah.
The ice cream is a good.
when you add all these other things to where you buy your ice cream, that's also a good, but it's not the same good as just ice cream.
Yeah, it's the ice cream, it's the whole package. You're buying, I mean, you don't buy the pure ice cream from a master, I guess. You're buying, I mean...
You never do.
Yeah,
you never do. Ice cream itself is never good, in a sense, because you're always buying a package.
It's more convenient to assume it's the same good if everything else washes out.
But then why, I mean, how can this definition have any meaning at all then? Because that's always the case.
No, it's not always the case.
Well, in fact, we're going back to what he was saying about ice cubes. I mean, an ice cube in winter is not a lot of value to you because all you do is put your milk outside on the porch instead. But in summer, you can't do that. So that's the real utility for ice cream.
It's exactly the same analogous
in this situation.
No, I don't have any difficulty understanding why things have different values. I'm trying to understand the definition of good because that's used all the time.
Yeah.
This implies, when you say an entity consisting of inhomogeneous goods, that's supposed to imply that goods are the same in the market, right?
Right.
You have ice, and it's ice. Well, period.
Yeah.
You might say that those glasses of water tomorrow when nobody's here is a different good.
Yes.
But right now there's 7 units of homogeneous supply right
these
there.
These 6 glasses, I don't care which glasses pick up. These are homogeneous to me, at least.
Right.
If you really want to nitpick, there's a degree beyond which, because even the glass that you've got your hand on is closer to you, and it is slightly better for you than the other one that's further away.
Right.
What I'm saying is, because they are physically identifiable units, they're never exactly the same.
The thing is, in life, it washes out. You don't really care about whether it's 2 inches, 6 inches.
Right.
It's up to the individual again whether he cares or doesn't care. That's the point.
Okay.
So, I mean, in other words, if you have 5,000 paper clips all the same size in a bowl, you know, I don't care about which paper clip. The paper clips are homogeneous, and most people would be homogeneous. Somebody else, however, could be in sort of not their own section, something. Not somebody loves this paper clip because I don't know.
Going back to the ice cream at
the restaurant is one good. All the ice cream at Swenson's is another
good. Right.
That's right.
I understand that. I'm trying to understand the definition of good as it's going to relate to our discussion about economics. Because in other forms of economics, assume that ice cream is ice cream, and so it should have the same value everywhere to every person, correct? Whereas Austrians recognize that a good in a given transaction is completely different
not completely. It could be.
Based on the value judgment.
The point is that what you're doing is you're diminishing the role of the outside economist, the observer, who's trying to figure out what's going on. You're less able to figure out what's going on, less able to manipulate the situation. You can't then say it's irrational. I'll give you an example. We had the first Austrian Lisa.
I was just going to say, maybe the distinction is that you want to describe a good as a physical object. That's the only way an objective observer can describe it. That's the only way the observer economist could appreciate it. Ice cream is what is in this thing. While Austrian would say, you are observing all characteristics of it, all benefits of it, possible and otherwise, which is only something you can observe, or something that no one comes.
Well, it depends on the individual. See, in most cases, Mill would be right. In most cases, I mean empirically. But it doesn't have to be. Let me give you an example. The first Austrian conference, the first modern Austrian conference outside of old Austria, the first one in modern time, was held in 1973 at a wild place. No, 1974. I think it was 74. Summer of 1974. A crazy place called Royalton College of Vermont. Okay, it's in southeastern Vermont. It's a place which is more or less of the income and standard of living of 1850. Place is decaying. It's got, got nothing. It's got no supermarkets. It's got no movies. It's sort of like a slice out of the happily forgotten past. The college was a fake college. It was a weird town. It was a college by an entrepreneur who was essentially a crook. So it was a fake college. They had a fake law school and a fake hotel. Anyway, it's a hilarious thing. We sometimes go into the anecdotes of this ambiance. So one of the things was that there were two grocery stores in this teeny town with a population of 400. It's like a Potemkin village. There's a big village green or common, and houses on the outside, and then nothing else beyond it. So like a Potemkin village or a movie. You have these fake houses, push them in, fall in. Nobody ever saw anybody in the town. Never saw a soul in the town ever. Anyway, there were two grocery stores right across the street from each other, like 10 feet. And we observe that the prices in these are totally different. It's the same product. One store, I don't know, whatever, you know. Same cake of soap, charging, you know, 50 cents. The other store is 25 or something. So this is, you know, getting mind blown here. What the hell's going on? We're supposed to be economists. How do we analyze this? So somebody found we finally found one of the villagers there. And said, how come this is going on? How come Zeke's store over here is charging different prices than Jake's? So a lot of the things in this town, there are two groups of people. Everybody, there's two groups of people in the town. Each group hates each other's guts. One group only goes to Zeke's, the other group only goes to Jake's, and none of them will cross-compete. There are no marginal buyers will shift from one to the other. It's a non-competing grocery store. Well, so that happens. I mean, it's a little nutty, but I mean, it's part of life. So usually, the prices of the soul will be the same. Okay? In this peculiar situation where everybody's got values where Zeke's, I must go to Zeke's, we're going to Zeke's is somehow more important than the actual price of the product, then the prices differ. So that's what happens. Generally, it's true, the price is the same thing.